Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Thursday, February 7th, 2013. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. Alaska State Troopers have been in Cake investigating a death since Wednesday morning, but have released few details about the investigation. Cake is a community of around 600 people on Kuprinoff Island, about 40 miles from Petersburg. Troopers received a report of a body discovered there just after 11:30 Tuesday night. Agency spokeswoman Megan Peters said the Alaska State Troopers from Juneau and the Alaska Bureau of Investigation from Anchorage, along with a crime scene response team from the State Crime Detection Laboratory, responded to Cake. Peters said Wednesday evening that investigators were not yet able to release information about the case, including the identity of deceased individual. Cake has no police department and is currently without a village public safety officer. Anyone with information in the case is encouraged to call the state troopers in Ketchikan at 225-5118. When it comes to commercial fishing in Alaska, women have a small piece of the pie. They make up about 11% of Alaska residents who hold a crew license. About 4% of permit holders are Alaskan women. The number comes from the state's Economic Trends newsletter, and they only include residents of Alaska. So painting a picture of exactly how many women work in the industry is difficult. But painting a picture of their experiences might be a little easier. That's what the Sitka Maritime Heritage Society hopes to do tonight at its annual meeting. The group is convening a panel of women to discuss their time in the commercial fishing industry. KCAW's Ed Ronco talked to one of them and has this interview.
Tella Adson's life at sea actually begins a few miles inland in Wasilla with her parents.
They had a dream, of a landlocked dream of going to sea, and so they started building a 45-foot sailboat in the backyard, and with the full-time jobs of being veterinarians, it took 7 years to complete.
When it was done, they sold the veterinary practice, launched the sailboat from Anchorage, and sailed across the Gulf of Alaska.
We landed in Sitka, and that was in 1984, when there were a lot of fishing families, like families with young kids running around in Thompson Harbor and folks who made trolling look like a lot of fun, and like it was something that a family could do together. So they rigged up the sailboat to be a hand troller, and that was how we got started.
I would imagine that it sounded like one of those things that, boy, that looks like a fun way to make a living, and then it turned out to be a little harder.
You know, I've just recently been going back through my folks' original logbooks, and like the very first few entries, they're out hand trolling by Vitskari Rocks, you know, right out in front of town, and they'll get like 2 coho a day and 10 humpies. So there was a pretty steep learning curve. Like there's a note, we made $19 today.
But it can't have been all bad, because the family soon upgraded. They built the Willie Lee Second, a 54-foot troller, and fished it for a few years. Eventually, Adson's parents split up. Her dad took a job on land, and her mom took the helm of the boat. Adson says, looking back on it, she's really proud of what her mom did and appreciates all the hard work that went into running a boat and raising a daughter at the same time. But back then, it was not always easy.
Because I was a really angry, obnoxious teenager, so we made one trip. We stayed out for 26 days, just the two of us, on that boat together, and, you know, a boat never gets so small as when you have two people in a conflicted, tense relationship, let alone a mother and a daughter.
Adson spent a little more time fishing, including for a captain who, she says, marveled at the novelty of having a woman on his crew.
I got really tired of being teased as the liberal little college girl, and it made me really bitter at an industry that I loved a lot. So I left after that season and took a break and went and did social work in Seattle.
After 6 years living paycheck to paycheck, she decided to come back to fishing and to Alaska. And she says she returned to an industry that felt much different.
I see a lot more women running their own boats. I see a lot of young women running their own boats.
Would you encourage young women today to get into fishing?
I would encourage any young person today to get into fishing, and I would certainly encourage a young woman to also. In anyone young and green who's coming to the fleet, I'm I always feel protective of them because they have no idea, you know, what's a good boat. They don't know what makes a good boat or a good captain. And I think that's particularly relevant for young women.
As a person who's a professional fisherwoman, and, you know, what's the proper nomenclature? Is fisherwoman okay? Fisher? Does everybody get called fisherman?
What you say is fine, Ed. we all have a different opinion. It's just like any group. We all have the term we attach to, and it's funny because, like, I'm super sensitive to using gender-specific terms for any other industry or group, and for myself, I adopt fisherman, so it just doesn't make any sense.
Everybody's different.
Exactly.
Okay, so as a fisherman, you're investing a lot of time and emotion and money, you know, in something that's pretty risky. So even as somebody who grew up with it, do you ever sit there and think, what am I doing?
Yeah, even having done this for, I think, 26 seasons, it's still scary as a profession. Like, are we going to make a living at this summer? Or
you also have a lot of love for it.
I have so much love for it. And, you know, and that's the thing, is that my partner also grew up fishing, and so he has the same amount of love for it. And neither of us ever imagined that we'd find a person that matched our passion and drive for fishing.
What I hear you saying when you talk about fishing is that it's the best job ever.
It is definitely the best job ever now in, you know, February, when I've forgotten mostly about all the worst days of last season. There are days during the summer, you know, with the sideways rain and you're not catching and it's just miserable out and things are breaking. You forget about those days because the other days are so good, and just the privileges of our life is just so good.
Tella Edson, talking with KCAW's Ed Ronco. She'll speak on a panel about women in the commercial fishing industry at 6 p.m. tonight inside Harrigan Centennial Hall. The event is free and open to the public. Several earthquakes have shaken up southeast Alaska since last fall. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver spoke with earthquake physicist Professor David Oglesby about why these latest quakes near Haida Gwaii in October and just off the coast of Craig in January are of particular interest to scientists. The quakes both generated very small tsunamis, but that doesn't mean that the fault may not produce tsunamis in the future.
On the evening of October 27, 2012, a magnitude 7.7 earthquake shook coastal British Columbia. The epicenter of the quake was in Haida Gwaii, formerly known as the Queen Charlotte Islands. It was the third largest recorded earthquake in Canada. David Oglesby, professor of geophysics at the University of California, Riverside, explains why this particular quake caught scientists' attention.
In southern Alaska and in Canada is what's called a transformed plate boundary, and it typically involves faulting that is horizontal, what's called strike-slip faulting, very similar to what you get in Southern California and Central California on the San Andreas Fault. And so those are the kinds of earthquakes that we expect to see in your region. This earlier event, the magnitude 7.7 west of Queen Charlotte Island, was not that type of earthquake.
To understand why this is important, we need to take a look at two different types of earthquakes and how they work. An earthquake is when the tectonic plates that make up the Earth's crust scrape against each other along fault lines. Most earthquakes in southeast Alaska are the type that involve strike-slip faulting.
The best way to think about it is take a map and draw a line on it, and then cut along that line, and then slide the two portions of the map horizontally past each other. It involves horizontal slipping on a relatively vertical fault.
The Himalayas are the highest mountains in the world. They were created by the other type of fault movement, called thrusting. This is the kind of quake that happened off of Haida Gwaii last year.
You had one plate thrusting underneath the other, so the two plates are actually pushing together.
Now, we fast forward to this year's January 4th quake that happened off the coast of Craig in southeast Alaska. It was an example of strike-slip faulting, but Oglesby says the two quakes might be related. He says the first thing that tipped scientists off is that the two quakes happened in the same region in a relatively short period of time. To find out more, scientists are looking at what happened with the forces inside the Earth's crust during these two events.
So you can look at how the rocks moved around in the first earthquake, And when rocks move around inside the Earth, then they redistribute forces in the Earth. And so they change the forces on nearby faults.
Sometimes the rocks move around in such a way that they take pressure off of the other faults and reduce the likelihood of more earthquakes happening. In other cases, the rocks jam up against each other, aggravating the already smashed faults and increasing the chance of a second earthquake. He says preliminary analysis of these two recent quakes leads scientists to believe the Haida Gwaii quake did put more pressure on the nearby fault and helped trigger the Alaska quake.
That's what I mean by there being a connection between the two earthquakes. That's not to say that the second earthquake wouldn't have happened by itself eventually, but it's possible that it was moved forward in time by a certain number of years due to this earlier earthquake a little bit farther south.
But there's another reason scientists are paying special attention to the Haida Gwaii quake. Southeast Alaska's typical strike-slip faulting can cause a lot of ground shaking, but it isn't as potentially dangerous for coastal communities as a thrusting earthquake.
Because a tsunami is generated whenever you can lift up or throw down a whole bunch of water. And so an earthquake that has a significant component of vertical motion can lift up or throw down the seafloor, whereas an earthquake that involves mostly horizontal motion tends not to have as much of tsunami potential.
The Haida Gwaii quake did cause some tsunami activity, and Oglesby says the region got lucky this time. It can be easy to forget about earthquakes when they're not happening, but Oglesby says it's important for Southeast Alaska to pay attention. He will be presenting his research on the Canadian and Alaskan earthquakes at the Seismological Society of America meeting this spring. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for Raven News. If you've missed any of our stories or would like to hear them again, please visit us online at kcaw.org. Today in Sitka, expect periods of rain mixed with snow, with highs around 39. KCAW Sitka.